You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. Patrick!
Tracy.
Yes. So, question. Have you ever read any of P.G. Wodehouse's books? The
No.
Jeeves and Wooster sorts of things?
Nope.
Well, fancy that. That creates an opportunity for us. J.P. LeCramp, can you tell us something about what makes P.G. Wodehouse's Jeeves and Wooster books so much fun?
That's a great question. I love the dynamic, and it's a dynamic you see in a lot of comedy. You know, in Wodehouse, it's the aristocrat doesn't know anything, and then the butler knows everything, and they have to sort of like coexist, and they're very codependent. But you see that like comedic premise in so many things. You see it in The Office, Michael Scott, or the one with Ricky Gervais, the BBC version first. You see it in Succession and Veep. Like, I loved Veep. It's just a great tool for, an engine for comedy, but also a great tool for satire. So you can sort of like satirize institutions and targets through that pretty simple comedic premise.
So without knowing what that was, I did write a story like that like 20 years ago that I never published.
I had
the aristocratic inventor guy who had all the great ideas, but he was really, really stupid. And then his butler was like the smart guy who knew how things worked, but was also actively trying to kill his master.
Which, you know, again, like it's such a there is like an antipathy there, I think, at some core level, because each person fails at what the other person is good at. Yeah. And there's got to be an antipathy there. So, it's just a great storytelling device, I think. That's why the Wodehouse stuff is still relevant. And again, you see it in so many places.
And of course, you're like the perfect person to pose this question to, because your book, Valet, which is coming out the very day that this episode itself is coming out. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Very much a kind of like near future SF vision of the same sort of madcap and whimsical thing going on there between Cy and Grayson. So congratulations, like I said. I'm really interested in a landscape where like science fiction tends to like skew to one of two extreme polarities with robots, right? Where we're either like desperately trying to humanize and adorableize robots, like the wild robot kind of phenomenon over here, right?
Uh-huh.
Or we're catastrophizing robots and artificial intelligence in all of the ways that tends to happen. For you, what's the fun of playing with the conceit that you have? We should probably pause here for a moment and give you a chance to like talk conceit first.
Okay, so it's helper robot. It's narrated from the robot's perspective, and it's a helper robot tethered to a pretty helpless human. And the human steals some very valuable information or property, and the two have to go on the lam all in an effort to save the family business. So that's sort of like the elevator pitch. Mm-hmm. So what interested me about it was almost from the other angle, like how much humans can be like robots, if that makes sense, not how much robots can be like humans. Like how robotic our thinking can be. And, I just find that super fascinating that we're always, like you said, like humanizing the robots without necessarily realizing how robotic we can be and how our mind works. And so that's sort of where I was coming at it from. I don't know if you guys have ever seen like a Sam Harris video, but I was watching this Sam Harris compilation video or something. And I was like, you know, robots can be kind of funny. And he's got a very robotic cadence and he's hyper rational. And so that's sort of where the idea came out of.
I think one of the things that's fun for me about The Conceit, having read some of the book up to this point, is the way that Sai, our narrator figure, who is the valet robot, is trying so hard to understand human behavior. And at the same time, in trying to understand human behavior, trying to like sort of coach the other robots around him. There's this really wonderful scene where the robots have been kind of shunted to the side to charge themselves in a restaurant while they're owners are having meals and things, and they are kind of passing the time by continuing to train themselves for understanding humans by watching sitcoms. And that in and of itself, I think, is this great opportunity to kind of play with the idea of like, what does it really mean? Like that roboticness that you're talking about there. Because like, what is a sitcom but like a formula for human behavior written into absurdity? But the sitcom you choose for the scene is really interesting to me, because you chose Family Matters, you know, the Steve Urkel, Officer Winslow vehicle. And I gotta ask why, because it's a very niche one. It's very recognizable.
That's a great question. You know, I think it was the tie into family. That in the show you have this, like, you have obviously the biological family, but then Urkel's always over there. But I just like the also like how demonstrative some of the characters are. You know, that the behavior is very like visual and would be easy to understand. But yeah, it was more an impulse than like a super calculated decision on it.
So then this question is going to land flat with you, but was it Family Matters before or after the one sister just vanishes?
So I'm not even that familiar with Family Matters. <That's not true. laughs> We were not allowed to watch television growing up. And so there's huge parts of pop culture that I missed. We were only allowed to watch like British comedy on PBS, which is, you know, kind of a tie into to Woodhouse. I caught all of that stuff after the fact. Definitely not steeped in Family Matters.
there was a sister that just basically got written out and just vanishes, and they never see her again. And I mean, it's just like one episode there, next episode not, and then just never
returns.
And that's not the first, like, I've seen that in other sitcoms back in the day.
They are so different in the 80s and 90s versus what's happening in the 21st century. What they could get away with is crazy.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, since you've given us the opening there, I feel that I do. I choose to ask. If you grew up watching PBS like British sitcoms and comedies and things like that, so what's the like starter pack of understanding the LeCrampe media brain?
Are You Being Served was a great one. I don't know if people are familiar with that, but you know, it's kind of similar where you had, and Keeping Up with Appearances was a little bit similar where you know, there's this like gap between how people present themselves to the world and how they actually are. That is a good tie into the book, I think. Faulty Towers. TV. So, and I'm a huge fan of the original Office, the BBC one with Gervais. So I just feel like the Brits do comedy really well. And it often does have like a heavy satirical element to it where something is being said about class or, that irony between how people want to be seen and how they actually are, how the rest of the world sees them.
So much of that is the kind of like the cultural norming of like, we all know what's actually going on here, but none of us are going to say the thing.
Yes. And the nicety, the niceties around that. But then when that cracks, I think all of that is super interesting and sometimes really funny. Yeah.
I feel like there's a through line to be drawn between the, this one's for you, Patrick, but like the Southern version of, we all know what's actually happening here and are not just going to say it explicitly, and
bless your heart.
British Yeah. It's
that's the phrase I thought of.
Yeah. I will never forget having had a conversation with a writer friend of mine a few years back at a conference. And he was very fond of the United States. His wife had a job in banking that had caused them to move from just outside of London to New York. And they'd been in New York for about 3 years. And he loved spending big chunks of the summer doing road trips throughout the United States. Because, you know, certainly just the vast amount of, you know, driving that one can do in the United States, completely different than in the UK, but also just crazily different biomes and landscapes and things too. And in the course of road trips, of course, he'd encountered tons of different like accents and food types and all this sort of stuff. And we started having a conversation at the bar after paneling that day. And somehow the concept of bless your heart came up. And it was an actually like shocking and somewhat painful revelation to him to be like, oh, no, that's not actually really that great.
Yeah.
It's a bit contextual, but they may have just told you to die in a ditch covered in petrol.
Yeah. Because yeah. I had the same thing when I started work at the company I work at now. I was in marketing, and they had me sit through the sales training because they just wanted me to know what they were like training salespeople on. And so this guy who's teaching this class is talking about when he worked in Atlanta. And he had this customer and he would see her, you know, every week, and she would come in and they would talk and he would do this. And he said, we just built rapport. He was talking about building rapport. And he's like, we just had this great rapport. And I remember like she said to me, bless your heart. And I hold that with me today. And I laughed in the class and he looked at me and he's like, what? And I go, oh, you don't know. Oh, bless your heart. You know, it's like, and I explained it to him, and I destroyed his world, unfortunately. Yeah. Like, his worldview was flipped because he did not realize what that actually meant. Like, he just thought that she was, like, blessing his heart.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's so much of what we're doing, too, is just, you know, these, like, castles made of sand and the, you know, like, we're just creating what we think of, you know, what we want in the world or what we want the world to CSS. And then there are these moments where you suddenly come face to face with the fact that that's not how you're seen, or that's not what people get from you. And I just think it's really profound, but also can be hilarious. Yeah. And some of the greatest characters for me, whether it's TV or film or books, are characters who are ignorant of that. And operate in the world as though their version of it is what everyone else is seeing. And
like middle managers.
Yeah. Confederacy of Dunces comes to mind. Michael Scott's such a great version of that. I think that's why he's so lovable to people.
Yeah.
That he just continues to, even though that he's constantly getting information that the rest of the world doesn't see him the way that he is hoping or that he's trying. He constantly operates as though they do. And there's something like hopeful and optimistic about that, even if it is ignorant and wrong. And
It's interesting though, because there is that difference between the British version and the US version in that in the US our humor is different. And in the British humor, a lot of it is meaner.
Yes.
And harsher. And that did not go so well when they – like the first season here.
The first season was just weird, right?
Yeah, like because they were trying to – yeah. And so it didn't really take off until they said, let's not do that. Let's change this up. Let's soften the edges a little bit.
Yeah, David Brent is so much less likable than Michael Scott, and the world around him is just much crueler.
Yeah.
And so that first season was just strange. And they even tried to like just take the same storylines, the same lines of dialogue and jokes.
And shot for shot in some cases.
Yeah. And it just didn't, you know, they didn't hit their stride until they made Michael Scott his own character and a much more lovable middle manager.
Yeah.
Which I think is also interesting because like most people's experience in the workplace with middle managers is they're not people they love.
No.
And so you're kind of asking something unusual of the audience there to look at someone who has a certain amount of privilege and a certain amount of power, who is like immune to self-reflection almost, and in their immunity to self-reflection is always kind of making their problems other people's problems and jumping to the wrong conclusions and redirecting everyone's energies in these frustrating ways. And to get the audience to see that, and on the one hand be like, oh yeah, that's my boss, but also to like it is a real trick.
And that this is what comedy can do, I think. And you're right. If Michael Scott was in charge of your promotions and the livelihood of your family, you would probably find him less lovable for sure.
Oh yeah.
But this is what I think comedy is so good at, and is getting you to either relate to a situation or a person in a way that you wouldn't in the normal course of your day or the world. And this is why I think satire is so valuable, is that it to like creates enough distance for you to see things a little bit differently. And it can be kind of disarming in that way. And so you can understand or critique something that you ordinarily would be like too close to, or, you know, like you say, you wouldn't find funny. I think if the comedy is right, it can navigate that very tricky balance that you just laid out.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think we're also like in the present moment, the year of our Lord, maybe 2026, in a weird place for being able to process satire, where I think on the one hand, we need it more than ever in light of just the way the world has been. I'm going to keep that in vague terms, but I think everybody knows the kind of stuff I'm.
It's an absurd time. And so absurdity lands differently. Yeah,
and,
totally.
I don't think about it myself. Like I don't think about the American people or what they're going through.
During these times, this guy. So. I see what you're doing there. Yeah. Yeah. But I guess.
But even outside of like the political context of it, the world is just very absurd right now. Yeah. Things that are ridiculous, like intentionally ridiculous to try and satirize, it's kind of tough to make it create that distance, because sometimes it can approximate things a little too closely, I think. Like, I don't know if you guys watched Veep or not, but like. Yes. It's, I don't know how they did that, because it is satire and it does very comically satirize those things. But then it also really does seem very plausible, especially in the 21st century.
Yeah.
How vain, how amoral, how ridiculous the people are.
Mm-hmm. I just think that we need to get off of this topic. So let's talk about UFOs. Let's release some UFO files. Let's just talk about that.
I also see what you're doing. I think that like one of the things that makes satire so tricky now, you make a great point that like we've reached sort of this peak level of absurdity where it's like, where do we go from here to satirize? Like if you're Alexandra Petri or something writing for The Atlantic sitting back, you must be like, well, what the fuck? What have I got left to work with here? But at the same time, I think like we also are in this difficult position because people are so agitated by the circumstances around them, by the feeling of being like besieged by other people's political agendas and values, and whether they are really in grounded fears or jumping at shadows. There's so much tension surrounding that I think as badly as we need satire to help us reset our thinking and our expectations, we've got our backs up badly enough that we don't know what to do with it anymore. Hence, here we're going to take a bite at Jimmy Kimmel again. And like, now we're going to say that somehow The Late Show isn't profitable and has to come off of CBS. And so we're kind of cutting out at the knees the very thing that we need, because we don't know how to receive it anymore and have decided it's not safe to receive anymore. And it's this kind of, it's deeply frustrating.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. The point about anytime tension runs high, I feel like there are opportunities to cut it with humor and satire.
Oh, yeah.
That is the way that you can actually comfort people. And so my hope would be that, you know, we're in obviously a very disruptive time, to put it mildly, and that, you know, maybe we're like how we satirize stuff, or, you know, what that looks like, that we're like catching up a little bit. Because I agree, it's a very tense time. People are very agitated, and I feel like comedy in general, but satire in particular, is so good at again, like lowering the temperature, allowing people to see things with a little more perspective and distance. That's what the irony does. And yeah, making the, like, just because you're making fun of someone doesn't mean that you don't respect them, or like, you know, you make fun of your close friends, you make fun of family members. It can be a way to show camaraderie or familiarity. And so,
and connection.
For 100%. And so, yeah, I think we definitely need it. And I hope we get more of it, not less.
I will throw it out there. I'm old enough to remember when David Letterman went on the air every night ripping GE and NBC apart, because GE bought NBC. And that was some of the funniest shit I had ever seen in my life at that time.
The Conan NBC Tonight Show fiasco was equally like really funny and kind of like strangely emotional and sentimental for viewers. You know, somebody like in real time coming to grips with their dream evaporating and using comedy as a way to explain it and get their mind around it. Like, that was some amazing television. And the Letterman too.
One of my favorite things that happened a couple of days ago. David Letterman was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He came on and he sits down. He's like, the strangest thing just happened. I was backstage. I was waiting to come on. And this guy walked up to me. He says, I work here at CBS and you're fired.
just getting people out of the way real quick.
And then he seemingly paid some guys to come on to the set and grab the furniture and take it away.
Because
he found out, he's like, who owns this, Stephen? Well, this is CBS. Oh, CBS owns it? Okay. And then like these guys come out and he starts handing them cash and they pick up the furniture. They took it up to the roof. And Stephen Colbert goes up with them and he's like, Dave, you know, one of the things that they said when I took this job, when I started the show, they specifically forbade me from throwing things off the roof. I am not allowed to do that because you used to do that. Dave's like, well, what are they going to do? Fire you? And then they just started throwing the furniture off the roof, the CBS owned furniture.
That's
off
awesome.
The roof. And it was hilarious. And it is satire. Yeah. It is because they put a CBS logo as a target on the street. That's what they were trying to hit with the furniture.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious.
You know, the idea of like, who owns that show? Is it CBS? Is it Colbert? Is it the viewers? Like, there is some larger point underneath that satire, I think.
Oh yeah.
And that's just a great Letterman bit.
Which brings us back to your book. So Tracy has been saying that it's valet. And my people are from the South, so I've been assuming that it was valet.
Yeah. I think originally it was called The Valet, and then the got dropped, kind of like a Sean Parker Social Network move. And you know, people just say valet. And so I think, either one is fine with me. But I originally thought of it as valet out of that British tradition.
Yeah. When I'm just curious, like, cause I like to every once in a while find out like how people, you know, come at their writing. When did you start writing this?
2020, late 2020. So I had written a book before, and it was terrible. Like every part of it was terrible. The process was awful. The end result was not good. I had had an agent who was interested in my work before and then was very uninterested. So like in every way that a book could fail, it failed. It was terrible to write. It took me like 3-4 years. And so, you know,
that just means you're a writer. Keep going.
Yeah. And so when the pandemic hit and in education, we went remote. And so I did have a lot more time and, you know, cause my commute had been several hours a day. And then you're talking about like you know, multiple sections lecturing. So I suddenly time opened up for me, and I just decided I wanted to write a book that was fun to write and was an enjoyable process, and that at the end of it, hopefully was enjoyable for readers. So I started that in like late 2020 and just kind of plugged away at it. I got a sabbatical in 22 and parental leave for my first child in 23. So I got a little bit of extra time there, and from that, I was able to get a complete draft.
Nice.
But it took a while.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It can. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Every overnight success has several years of hard work behind
it. Oh, man. Yeah.
I think one of the really interesting things for me about this circles back to the idea of comedy and like, how do we kind of leverage the shortcomings of characters to make them both lovable and to create some useful friction and so on, is like, you also want characters, at least the characters who are at the center of a story, to grow at least some and to change some. And so there has to be a certain amount of trickiness. And maybe this is something that the runway that you had in the writing process helped you work out. There had to be a certain amount of trickiness in figuring out, how do I take this very flawed human being and their valet, who is, you know, much more competent, but has their own limitations too, and take them on a journey where they grow and they change and they become better, but don't diffuse the things that make them fun and funny and create that friction.
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge right there. Luckily, you know where they're, or hopefully at some point, you know how they're flawed. So you know what needs to change, you know, where they need to get to, kind of, even if you don't know how they get there or how to make it believable or how to preserve the dynamic. But for the robot, you know, like the growth is more evident, because you can just get an upgrade. Mm-hmm. You can literally change the hardware or software and see growth from that. Mm-hmm. Obviously humans, it's a little more complex, although, you know, again, I think we're more like robots than we typically acknowledge. And so you have to, I guess it's gotta be incremental and it's gotta be believable, and it has to work within the elements of the story that you've already established for the reader. And so, you know, it's got to come out of the plot and it has to feel organic to that. But yeah, that's the challenge. And it can be a really joyous challenge, I think, finding out like how somebody would grow within this particular scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned a couple of times, we're more like robots than we think.
Can you
give an example that doesn't cut the knees out of something in your own writing, of something you think of as, we think of this as just being persons, this is just being human, but it's actually kind of robotic.
Yeah. Well, the way we calculate probabilities of things,
tell me the odds, kid.
You know, like, I think I think I'm more rational than I end up being. And, you know, I think the rational parts are like kind of robotic. And then there's this other part that comes in that's irrational, where a lot of like the mystery of human consciousness and human, where that all comes out of, that we just decide to do something or have an impulse or, but yeah, like day to day routine decision making, I think a lot of it does, if you pull back from it, it can look like you're running an algorithm. Yeah. And is it all that different from what an android like Sai in the book would be doing? And yeah, I just think that's an interesting reality to confront. And, you know, again, to me, it's all about, you know, trying to figure out like what makes humanity unique. Like, what is it about about human consciousness that we feel so singularly unique? And a lot of it comes back to that like irrational part.
Or barbecue.
Well, but the decision to put barbecue sauce on a hot dog, like, you know, what I mean? Like,
I mean, something that is my reason.
Yeah. There's something unique about that. And I think when you start to look at those elements of a person, that's when they do become lovable and sympathetic. But also when you like learn something about them individually, but you know, again, like what it means to be human, that you can get all of that from those like slight irrational impulses that we have.
I have an irrational impulse right now, Patrick.
Yeah?
Yeah. I want to talk about picks of the week.
We'll get to picks of the week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes, like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month, and that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month, and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever, our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Ta-da! All right. So, Patrick, what's your pick?
I have two. Because a second one manifested as we were
double-barrel picks of the week.
So the first one, I mentioned a couple weeks ago that because of Molly Tanzer, I started watching an anime show on Netflix, and then that led me to a second anime show. And then when I told my friends about it, they're like, oh, well, if you like those, by the way, there's more seasons of those shows on Crunchyroll.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck. Because what it is, another streaming service. So I signed up for a 7-day free trial specifically so I could watch.
You just blitz through it.
The additional seasons of Frieren and the Apothecary Diaries.
This but is what people I also, who don't have a 3-year-old and a newborn do. By the way, I'm just gonna throw that. Yes,
I found another show on there that I'm finding interesting. I really like the style of the animation and the artwork, and it's called Witch Hat. And then I don't know how to pronounce the third name. I'm going to say Altelier. It's Atelier.
Okay.
And this is on Crunchyroll. And there were 6 episodes. And I watched it. And I felt like, it's a good show. I like the animation. It's a neat story and stuff. But 6 episodes is really weird. Why is it only 6 episodes? Well, it turns out they're releasing an episode a week because they're fucking pissing with me. I don't care.
They know that you're going to cancel.
Yeah. Cause they knew I was going to cancel my 7 day.
Yeah.
But, it's a neat little story. It's about magic. And, there's this girl named Coco and she wants to be a witch more than anything else. Cause only witches can use magic. And, but her mom's like, you're not a witch, so you can't use magic. It's like this big, huge secret. And then a bunch of stuff happens and she becomes gets to become an apprentice. And the animation is really neat and I just like it. So that was pick number one. Pick number two, developed because of our conversation, which is, it is the season where you can go to the Home Depot and get a really good hot dog. Cause the hot dog stands have opened up. In front of the Home
Depot has hot dog stands.
Yes, that might be a Colorado thing.
It's not just a Colorado thing because Lowe's does it too, but they're California. They do it as well. It's usually an independent company. It's not the Home Depot.
Okay, all right.
It's someone buys that spot or rents that spot from the Home Depot, and they get put in a hot dog shaped
like a wrench or something.
Yeah, no, it's outside, and usually it's either a truck or a cart or something like that. And it is that season, and you can go and get a really good damn hot dog for lunch if you wanted to.
Well, okay.
And in some areas, like where Tracy lives, it's pronounced the Home Depot. Mm-hmm. But in other areas, it's the Home Depot. So,
sure. I at this point, you could persuade me of anything. There's hot dogs outside.
But there's nothing better than when you're going there because you need to fix something or you need something, and you get out of the car and you smell those hot dogs cooking, and they've got brats and they've got all kinds of stuff, and yeah, it's good.
So it's a full food truck hardware store experience.
Yes. Yeah, half the time you get the hot dog and stuff and you're sitting there eating it and then you forgot to get whatever you needed from the Home Depot and you go home.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a really transportive hot dog. It's hot dog amnesia at that point. Yeah.
I mean, if you can – so there's the thing where you can get the all-beef Vienna hot dog, you know, from a lot of these places. So –
all right, I'm gonna go with you on that one. So, JP, how about you? What is bringing you joy?
So it doesn't have to be a new thing, right?
It could be anything.
So my 3-year-old, we're like showing him Disney movies, and we show him Aladdin, which
Prince
I had not
Ali,
seen.
Fabulous he, Ali,
it's
Ababa.
So good. Yeah, that
genuine
song is
show
so
some respect down on one knee.
I'm not like a huge Robin Williams fan, but he is so good in that movie.
30,000 years can leave such a crick in your neck.
Yeah, it is like such a great. Although I will say, I feel like Aladdin does oversell things a little bit. He's like a shoplifting street rat, and he's promising this princess that he's going to show her the world,
a whole new world.
Like, yeah, I feel like she's probably traveled before.
Seems like
my cousin had 4 kids in rapid succession, and I was the babysitter, so I know all of those movies.
Yeah,
from the 90s and stuff, like all of them.
The other one that has brought me a lot of joy is Where the Wild Things Are, the book. It is gorgeous. Like the pictures are gorgeous, but then the stories. Like I never understood the story really as a kid when you're having that read to you.
Sure.
But the story is really good too. And it's so sparsely told. And so those two things, let's see. I saw this video of a deer swimming in the San Francisco Bay. Like I don't get to watch, as we said, I got a 3-year. So I don't get to watch like full TV shows or films unless it's Aladdin. But, I saw this clip of a deer in the San Francisco Bay and it was just haunting to see it swimming in there. That was stuck in my brain for a little bit.
I remember when I went to San Jose with my grandmother to visit my aunt and uncle, it was like a big deal. We had to go over the Golden Gate Bridge. It was like a huge big deal. It's like, we have to do it. I'm like, why? It's a bridge.
And then you went and were you transported? And did you forget?
Yes, I was transported from one side of the bridge to the other side of the bridge, where we then turned around and
we got hot dog hurts.
Yeah, I mean, that is how bridges work. Like once you get to the one, unless you live on the other side, like you're kind of,
And then it's like point thing. Alcatraz is over there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You buried the lead there. Oh, Lord. So this is a weird pick of the week, and it is born of the fact that we're having somebody over later today for dinner, and I'm going to be cooking and things. And it's also, I live in the Chicago area right now. We are going to have our first 80 degree day of what is beginning to quickly look like summer.
Aww. Welcome to the party, pal.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you've had the lockdown on the weird hot weather going on over there.
I've had my air conditioner on for a week because of it.
Wow. No. Yeah. But it's been very seesaw-y over here. So my pick of the week is just, this is so silly, but like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this with my whole chest. It's corn on the cob, bro. It is just corn on the cob.
Yeah.
Because last weekend I got some really bitchin' corn on the cob that we had with burgers, and I'm making flank steak tonight, and I'm going to do corn on the cob again. And if you can't get decent corn on the cob wherever you are, I'm really sorry, because that's unfortunate. And it can't be frozen. Not frozen crap. Little weird niblet things like you get from a church barbecue or something like that. None of that. No, we got to go. Has to come from a plant, and with that you were able to see at some point. Yeah.
The grocery store where you go in and they got the big bin and you pull them out and you're actually pulling the ears and you're pulling all the stuff off of them and cleaning them up.
See, I understand why people do that. Yeah. They do that in the grocery store because they're like, I'll leave the mess here. But fun fact, from the time that you shuck the corn, it accelerates the process of the sugars in the corn converting to starches, so it will be less sweet. Mm-hmm. So don't do it. Don't do it in the store. Just do it on your back porch or something in the yard and let the wind take away the little silks or whatever. But like, if you want legit sweet corn, you cannot just stand there with all the grandmamas and stuff and do it in the grocery store. You're going to short yourself.
Interesting.
So yeah, there's an actual chemical thing there. There's a process now, by which.
Now yeah. I know. And knowing now you know. Is half the battle.
Yep. The rainbow thing right there in the corner.
Wait, how do you cook it? You cook it on the grill or you cook it?
You wrap it in foil. You put the butter inside the foil.
See, you can put the butter in. You can cook it in the husk. Just put the butter in the husk. Yeah. And
you can. My grandma was a fan of just like she would peel it back and she would pull all the silk out of it. And then she would cover it back up again. And then she would steam it in the microwave as a bit of a cheat. I'm a big fan of put it all in the big pot of salted water. You boil it for 3 minutes exactly, then you turn it off. And then you let it sit there for like 2 minutes and then you're done and you drain it out. But like you can't go longer than that. Otherwise you're going to end up with some mushy shit. So
I like the foil. I like to wrap it in the foil, put the butter in the foil.
So I don't have a very big grill, so I just don't have enough space for that is the thing. So if I've got to make a choice between being able to actually cook the main or cook the
I am yep. texting your husband.
All right.
Get you a new grill.
Get
Home Depot.
The yeah. Home Depot.
Get yourself a hot dog and a grill.
Let's talk about a Traeger.
More importantly than the hot dog and the grill, get yourself a book, get yourself valet or valet, depending on your linguistic inclinations from JP LeCrempe. JP, it has been awesome talking to you. Where can people find you and the super cool things that you are doing?
So I have a website, jplecrampe.com. But pretty much this book is the only cool thing that I'm doing right now.
I read your McSweeney stuff. That's fun too.
Oh, that's very nice.
And you're raising another generation of nerds. So
that is true.
Also cool.
I'm you know, very humbled by the fact that the book's coming out and that people might pick up a copy of it.
Very cool.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. @the-functional-nerds on Facebook. @functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's just not, it's just going to, it's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY.social. I know, I couldn't keep a copacetic. I tried, but it just, hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, I really love what you do," I'm like, "I'm sorry. Do you know who I like? I think you have me confused with someone else."
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.